Hi, everyone. So this is where, in a normal, successful podcast, you might hear a sponsor ad, something we've been missing at Coach Your Brains Out. So we're asking for some listener help instead. If you enjoy the show and are able to support it, we'd love to have you head over to our Patreon page at patreon.com/coachyourbrainsout. Anything you can contribute, even a dollar an episode, $4 a month, would really help cover our hosting costs and John Mayer's speaking fee and help us continue doing the show. That's patreon.com/coachyourbrainsout. Thank you. We appreciate the support. Now here's today's episode.
Welcome to Coach Your Brains Out, the show that explores learning from the top minds in volleyball and beyond. With your hosts, John Mayer, Billy Allen, Andrew Fuller, and Nils Nielsen.
All right, we're joined by three-time All-American from UCLA, an AVP legend, an Olympian, and now a broadcaster, Kevin Wong. Thanks for coming on.
Hey, you guys.
Kevin, besides being an imposing player at 6'7", at least to John and I, you were also regarded as a savvy veteran who found little ways to control the game and gain mental edges. Would you say that's a fair description, or is it just in our heads?
I think if you're not figuring that out by the time you're a veteran on tour, you're losing some of your competitive edge, right? As you start losing vertical, you better start figuring out some of the other things.
So that wasn't always a part of your game. Like early on, you weren't thinking that way.
Oh man. Well, out of UCLA, we had the swagger, but, I was just coming in full blown attack mode, you know, like there was probably a lot of Casey Patterson in my game back then.
So then what are, as you aged and as you became a veteran, what were some of the things you'd use to try to gain a mental edge over opponents?
I think you just learn along the way, right? And it's different times too. So I think that's part of the difficulty now. It's a bit bigger challenge, but, obviously momentum is one of the big, ways that's really important in any sport, right? So how do you speed things up when things are going well? How do you slow things down when they're not? And, back when I was playing kind of in my prime, it wasn't a 12-second clock. It was, you had some time to go wipe off your glasses. You had some time to interact with the crowd. So there were a lot of opportunities to control momentum.
So you were aware kind of when things were going your way, you were trying to play faster, trying to like step back and serve as fast as you can, things like that.
Yeah. I think that you start figuring that out. Right. I coach a lot of kids these days, and I feel like too much time is spent on the little things, right? The details, your angles and your platform and all these things. And I think that what I learned from a lot of the best competitors, playing with Karch along the way, it's the big things that really matter.
So do you teach your players to start stepping into the court when they're serving like you did? conserve some distance.
Right. That's part of it, right? Is how do you shave? How do you become more efficient? Someone called me the Prius one time, and I kind of took that as a little bit of a compliment, right? You got to beach volleyball is an endurance sport too, right? So how do you get every bit of benefit? And I wasn't one of those guys who could outgrind other people in terms of conditioning, so I had to figure out some other ways.
Kevin, do you remember any stories where it was the mental side that got into a player's head you were playing?
Yeah, you know who I learned a lot from was Stein, and he had it at a young age. He's just, I think good players know how to take care of themselves and get themselves ready to play. I think great players can do that, and they can also help their partner get better. And then I think the Hall of Famer types, at least in my book, then they can also affect the other side. And Stein was a guy who knew how to push people's buttons. I remember a final where we were getting ready to play against Ricardo and Emmanuel. They were like the best team in the world. And Stein just had this little glint in his eye before the match. And he's like, you watch this. I'm going to get Ricardo freaking out within the first 5 points. And, when someone on your team like that and you're getting ready to go into to battle, and there he got that much confidence. It's infectious, right? And the next thing you know, he was chirping in Ricardo's ear, and Ricardo was starting to freak out, and he was, you know, he just kept on pressing that button, and we ran away with that one.
Is this, you think this is a, like a learned skill, like, you know, with players, would you try to develop this, or is this something like kind of part of Stein's DNA or part of, you know, certain people's DNA?
I think it's like everything, right? You know, some things might come more naturally to you, but I think that you can practice it all. And he had a natural gift, but like, you know, you get better at it. You get better at it. Whether some players you celebrate more against and some players you celebrate less against. You know, for Phil, anytime I played Phil, I didn't celebrate much at all.
Because he was blocking you all the time, or
yeah, that's what? Why I don't celebrate against him.
Dude, actually, the crazy thing is, maybe I'm misremembering, but I think my win percentage against him is kind of like maybe like somewhere between 20% and 30%, which
pretty high,
which is pretty good, you know, for how dominant he's been.
Yeah, mine's more like 2 or 3%, I think.
Yeah.
Were there any times where maybe some of these tactics or chirping backfired against an opponent?
I remember back in UCLA days, that was even before that, I was just, you know, I was coming off the bench and I was just in the starting lineup and we played against Stanford and it was Dave Goss. And early first and second set, I probably stuffed him 5 balls just in his face. And he was an All-American. And, you know, each celebration for me was bigger and bigger. And then all of a sudden he woke up in the third set, and the third, fourth, and fifth set, he was unstoppable. He broke the NCAA record, 55 kills. And I was just like, hey, maybe that wasn't the smartest sleeping dog to wake up.
Yeah. So I'm thinking about this. So maybe take me through this. So you're preparing for a match, say later in your career, or someone like Stein. So you're kind of checking within yourself. How am I feeling? Where am I at? And then you're thinking about, okay, where's my partner at? How can I help them out? And then you're kind of sizing up the other side, like, you know, who's the victim over there? Is that the process?
I don't know if it's that. You know, right? You get a book on how to beat teams.
Yeah.
And sometimes how to beat teams is get a block and celebrate and just ride them. Sometimes it's to take a person totally out of the game, right? So, I think that's the thing, is that, like, this is towards the more advanced stages, and a lot of times at the more advanced stages is it depends. It depends on the feel that you have. It depends on how much history you know on the other side. It's an art. It's not a science, I don't think.
Yeah. Yeah. So I can imagine if you're not feeling like yourself, you're kind of focused on that and taking care of your own game first. That's the first step.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's a great. Good point, right? You take care of the first things first, big things right. First.
So then you talked about it before, but wondering more, you know, especially in long tournaments. I know you played in Manhattan Beach. I think you and maybe Fenoy played just a ton of matches in the deep sand and pretty hot weekend. Just wondering, like, in situations like that in our sport where it becomes an endurance sport, how you would kind of go into that Prius mode. What's some things you would do to help yourselves get through that?
I think some of the same things that Phil does, right? Where you don't celebrate as much. You're not running around doing cartwheels as much. You can burn a lot of calories out there if you want, or you can keep it a little bit more focused. And I think, like, a lot of people give Phil a little bit of grief on that, but you know, when you're playing as many matches as they are every weekend, and not just one weekend, but the whole summer, you kind of got to go in that mode a little bit.
And what about in between matches? What are you doing to kind of recover and make sure you're ready for the grind?
You know what I didn't do enough of, and I look back on, I should have been jumping in the water after every match. Mm-hmm. You know, especially in California, especially when we got that nice cold water. I feel like I could have done a better job of that. Yeah, it's, you know, I look back and I just go, wow, I wish I could have made some, made some changes along the way.
Would you ever do things like early in the tournament, kind of alter the way you'd play, like maybe shoot around more or try to save yourself a little bit?
For sure. I think, you know, like it depends on where you are in your career, right? If you're just trying to grind out battles, then you got to play your A game every time. But if you, you know, there were years when I had first two rounds were pretty cake, right? And you're just working on your range, you're working on your cutty, your line shot, you're not hitting as much, you're playing efficient, and you're, you know, you also know you got to stay in the winner's bracket. So I think another thing I did was I split block way more than, you know, probably max efficiency. I guess I would kind of say, like in poker, the poker world, there's a certain play that's best on one specific hand. But if you look at it as a macro tournament, sometimes you're not making the most efficient play on each play because you're thinking about the big picture.
Mm. And John, have you, I know I don't enjoy hitting lines quite as much as I did when I first started playing. John, is there anything that's changed as far as your approach to the game in this regard? You're pretty Prius-esque.
Yeah, for sure. I think I used to, I want to bounce some balls and I'd run and shag it. And in between plays, I'd run everywhere. Now I kind of linger around and maybe hit a couple balls in warmups. And yeah, it's way different. I feel like it's a lot more of a kind of get your mind right than your body will be ready once the match starts.
Hey, you guys got me curious now. What? I know you guys are both good at getting yourself ready. You've developed into being really good teammates and getting your partners ready. Have you guys gotten to the point where you're pressing people's buttons and stuff?
Not me. I'll never be the great player. I feel like that's I feel like that's something I don't even consider. I mean, I treat everybody like they're the Phil, where I just ignore them. The only difference would be, I think when I played Ty Trambley, I compliment him a lot.
Yeah,
because he wants to get mad.
Right, so that's a little bit of games.
Yeah, great shot, Ty. Man, that was really good. Wow.
Yeah, I think I'm the same way. I don't know. I feel like I'm not there. I'm just a good player, not a great player.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think I feel like I put all my thoughts into. It's hard enough for me to try to side out and serve, and so I'm just kind of focused on me. But I'd love to be able to get people rattled and get some points that way too. That's why we're talking to you,
Kevin.
I think back on like Karch, right? He didn't do anything outwardly gnarly. He would celebrate, right? He was super aggressive. I think the thing about him was that you knew you were for a battle every single time you played against him. And that was pretty intimidating, right? Because you knew you had to be ready. And there was a consistency. And so maybe that's where you guys are. You guys are on the Karch track of consistency.
Oh, yeah. We'll take that. We're just like Karch.
And Kevin, you mentioned with some of the kids that you teach at the youth age, you know, maybe a lot of clubs are working on the fundamentals with ball control and stuff like that. But what are you teaching them, I guess, on the mental side that maybe some other clubs are overlooking?
Some of these things, right? And I think that you guys are onto it. I saw a John Mayer practice, and I think you guys are totally in that realm. I like indoor. We have techniques to slow the momentum down, you know, and you got to practice them. And it sounds crazy, but an extra 10 seconds out there, an extra 15 seconds, all of a sudden I don't have to burn a timeout, and it serves the purpose. I think the rule of thumb, when you got the momentum, you want to play as many plays in that time as possible. When you don't have the momentum, you want to slow things down until you get the momentum back.
Cool. And where did you learn some of these tactics? Is this something that you see going away in today's game, or is it something that is just is important now as always?
I think you guys are more subtle about things now, right? I feel like there's more accountability. It's social media. There's instant replays. There's people watching, I think back in I played in the Wild Wild West, and so you know, at Punahou, we learned to wipe the floors, you know, make sure that floor was super dry, especially when we were giving up points. At UCLA, I learned that the refs are human and they're going to go on body language, and you got to help them make some close calls, especially. So touches and lines, you got to you got to emote the body language that you would emote for the call that you want. I don't think it's, you know, I think it's most winning programs, I feel like they do similar things.
And I know you mentioned being a poker player, and I think there was a time where you were a lot more avid in it. Was that kind of a part of your, maybe as you became a veteran, did you get into poker at the same time? Was that kind of part of this gamesmanship? I think those two came hand in hand.
I think at the highest level of beach volleyball, it's you know, like when I think about, I think Johnny's there. I know you're there. I didn't mean that as a dismissive thing, Johnny. I know that you're both there. I would put Haydn near the top of the list. I wrote some notes down, and I think like level one of beach volleyball, it's trying to control the ball. And then level two is you start communicating and you're working with your partner a little bit more. Level three, you're bringing in vision. And I feel like for a lot of players, it takes forever. They might not even get to level three. You know, a lot of players are just looking at the ball. And then at level four, it's like I have my vision, you see me, and all of a sudden it's a poker game, right? Is are you going to break? Are you going to stay? What did you do last time? What did you do the last time I played you in this situation? And I feel like that's where, for me, it becomes really fun to play beach volleyball.
Mm. So you would have, you kind of go through like prior hands or prior matches to remember kind of some of their strategies going into
matches. And then you build these macro strategies, right? Like I remember Dax Holdren was the first guy who would ever go to the line early on defense. Right. And no one does that. I don't know if anyone does that much now anymore. But like that was baffling for me because it changed all my vision patterns, because you're used to seeing someone somewhere in the angle. You're used to seeing them lean or fake it was really a tough adjustment for me. And for a lot of players, I don't even think they would even notice it. Right. Because they were watching the ball. But I had to kind of break it down. And all of a sudden, my way to beat Dax was all the fakes, everything else, I would just make him move as far as I could on every play, because he was in Prius mode and I wanted to make sure that I made him, you know, in long distance mode. So if he was in the line early, I'd hit a cutty far away. Even if he was breaking, that's okay, because he had to do a lot of work.
Yeah, I feel like that part of the game, they're thinking this, I'm thinking that, the chess match is where it's fun too, because I feel like I played John Mayer so many times at practice, and then I play him in tournaments too, and we both know each other's game, and that's where it's kind of exciting, because I feel like you play a team that for the first time you're kind of just reacting a lot, where John it's like, right. I know he thinks I want to do this every single time, so I gotta throw this in a little bit.
Billy wants the shoot line.
Right,
but I'm sitting on it.
He still does,
you know,
it.
Like for example, I play against Phil, and I would script out my first four side outs of the match. I would come in and go big jump, line shot. And the reason why is they never block angle for the whole first set, almost the first half of the set for sure. They're a team, and maybe they've changed since, but like I just knew how I would play against certain teams, you know, that he's an old school player. He wants to seal line, make you go really high. Nick wants to sit in the angle, and that's kind of, you know, I had, and every team I had a little bit of a different book on them, on their tendencies.
Why do you think you had – is that part of the reason you had success against Phil? I mean, obviously, siding out against him is challenging. But I think you also blocked Todd pretty well.
Yeah. What was my secret on Todd? I would start in the middle. I'd give him line. I'd always give him a little sliver of line and then jump back to it, because he was the best at feeling you leaving the line. So if I flipped it on him and started a little bit in the middle of the court, it was much tougher for him to read, right? It was a different visual pattern.
Nice. And while we're on the subject, do you have any stories of roofing John Mayer and getting in his head?
Johnny Mayer is, I got him early in his career, right?
Oh, yeah.
I get him
got
early
me a lot.
In his career. I got him
got
a
me
lot.
A lot.
I would do the little baby V where, you know, you stand in the line and then your seam hand gets real active, which I feel like is a place where a lot of people get blocks.
It looked like angle was open every time.
Yeah. Yeah.
Took it away.
And I didn't I was good against players who weren't going OT. The guys who killed me were Jake Gibb, right? Because there's no it's not poker. It's like war, and he's got all the aces and he's just going right over the top.
Nice.
Yeah, but Johnny got vision, and all of a sudden he owned me. I don't think I scored any points against him after that.
Right.
I don't remember that. So if you were, you got to play in a couple different eras in the even the bigger court with some big personalities, and you saw a lot of changes throughout the years. But if you were to rank maybe in the pantheon of gamesmanship, like who's the top three all time who are able to really kind of change the match, outside of their play.
I'd say Karch, just because of his gnarliness and who he was. And it wasn't gamesmanship, but it was like you think about it, it's like the intimidation factor, and he had that. You go into a match, you knew you were in for a grinded out battle. I think Stein was the next guy. He was a guy who could pump you up, make you feel unstoppable. He could also get in the other team's brain. Sometimes it was worth 3, 4, 5 points. And also he was great at, they talked about Shaq being like the big canopy tree for some of his teams, where he took all the heat and all the pressure because everyone was looking at him and everyone else could kind of hide in the canopy and play their game. I feel like sometimes with Stein it was the same thing. After that, I don't know, man. Throw some other ideas out at me.
Big drop off, huh? I think you're number three then.
No, I'm not. I was too much in my own brain, you know? Like, you got to be...
What about Hav?
Hav was, like, aggressive. You always knew he was going to be aggressive. I think MD was the guy who was a little bit more... He'd play possum sometimes. He was the opposite of Karch, right? He would just, like, he'd barely jump. He'd barely move around the court, but, like, he had these bursts, and he would save. I remember talking to him at one point in time, and he's like, I'm not going to run for that line shot. I'm going to wait for that line shot because I know at, 14, 13, you're going to hit line and I'm going to run to it and I'm going to save that point for the end. Right. So it's kind of like some different thinking. I think he was underestimated, and he was also a great team player.
Yeah.
I feel like
I feel like all three of those are great teammates too.
Yeah. Yeah, if I have one regret, I think I would have gone back and I would have been a better teammate. I feel like I didn't learn that empathy and I didn't learn that side. I was such a perfectionist, and I just had this this too high a bar. And if I had done it again, I think I would. That's what would have been my biggest regret, my biggest change, is being a better partner.
Yeah, that's huge. I think when Todd was on here, he had the same thing. And I feel like he was maybe more of an obvious choice for him about being hard on his partners. Speaking of the Stein thing, I think I remember at the end of his career, he was coaching you, John, you and Brad a little bit.
Yeah.
And then he was also kind of came back and started playing. And I remember a match where he was serving Brad underhand deep and putting him, just wrecking him.
Yeah, and it worked. I still have nightmares about that match. Yeah.
So it was the comeback trail, and he had no shoulder, and he beat you guys?
Him and Mark Williams. No, he could swing fine. He just wanted to serve, like, this high, deep middle ball and move Brad, like, all the way back to the end line.
I feel like that's, like, the least utilized serve. Like, if I was to go back and coach college women, I think that, like, all my blockers for sure would serve that ball because it's so hard to pass. It's so hard to set. It takes you out of your rhythm. And it's cumulative, right? So, I feel like that people aren't doing that enough.
That was part one with Kevin Wong. Join us next week for part two.